Today on Wings, an exclusive interview with Chitra Radhakrishnan of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This is Wings series producer Frieda Worden. On November 4, 2014, at a women's conference in Geneva, I lunched with Chitra Radhakrishnan. She is a project manager on trade disputes for UNCTAD, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. This was a rare opportunity to probe the ins and outs of international trade with someone committed to a women's perspective. Due to time constraints, we had our interview in a UN coffee shop. Please imagine yourself there with us and ignore the background noise.
Chitra, are there issues related to women's advancement that fall into your line of work?
My line of work is connected, remotely connected. I actually did a presentation for the Irish Women on Women's Day on the connection between women in trade and dispute settlement. Because very interestingly, the number of women bringing cases to international dispute settlement is quite low. Now, that can be positive, but it can also be a reflection on the activity of women in international trade.
So what kinds of disputes might women want to bring to this kind of settlement forum?
I think that the best thing in dispute settlement is dispute avoidance. Because you are not in business to go for a fight. You're in business to make money and to benefit from the options of dealing with partners locally, nationally, regionally, internationally. So I always say, if you know the rules, you know how to use the rules effectively to optimize your trading opportunities and then avoid disputes, because nothing is as time-consuming, energy-consuming, and money-consuming as an international trade dispute.
Give me an example of an international trade dispute so people will have some idea what we're talking about.
Let me take one that caught the attention of many people, and that is the case of hormone beef imports into the EU. The US exported its beef products to the European Union under what we know as the World Trade Organization's rules, because some 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, the World Trade Organization was created after a long 10 years negotiations in what we call the Uruguay rounds, trade rounds to basically dismantle tariffs. Tariffs are things when you export something to another country, the importing country says, okay, you're sending these goods to my country, I want the X percent tax levied on the import duties. So the price could be higher than the price of what the local producers are bringing to the market. So your beef would be, let's say, $10 per kilo in the US, and it would be then $15 in the European Union because of the tariffs. Now, under the Uruguay round, under the Marrakesh agreements, the tariffs were brought down, harmonized, lowered, abandoned in certain cases, and that made it easier to sell your products and your goods abroad. Now, why I'm mentioning the hormone beef case? Because at one point, the Europeans said, look, listen, your meat cannot enter our markets because of the hormones in there, and there is a special agreement as part of the WTO package of agreements that deals with sanitary and phytosanitary measures. Now, these sanitary and phytosanitary measures are basically, if a government says, look, this is bad for the health of my people, I don't want it. That's what the European Union said. Then the Americans came with experts and he said, no, absolutely safe to consume, etc. And the case has been going on and on and on and on. So that's a case, a typical case.
So these are disagreements between governments, or are businesses in it, or are individuals in it? At what level can people bring a case?
So now you come to my particular field, dispute settlement, because people should not forget that international law is a relatively new discipline in the area of trade. International trade law is law that is being made and being created. The interesting thing is that international law was law amongst states and between states, so it's interstate law. At the national level in your own country, you have national laws. Between countries on the international level, you have international law. But who trades? It's not governments that trade anymore, because in the olden days, you had some state-owned companies that traded, especially in the Soviet bloc, etc., in the communist countries. But nowadays, it's business and companies that trade. For investment cases, this was already foreseen. The World Bank therefore set up a kind of dispute settlement center. They called it the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, because they say investors are companies, not governments. So let the investors have a way of settling an international dispute with a state. So an investor can take a state to court. It's not a real court, it's an arbitration court, but you can take them to court, by way of speaking. In trade, you can't, under the WTO rules. You still have to go to the WTO dispute settlement body, basically a trade court, international trade court, but the state has to take the case. So that means the trader, the company, the business has to ensure that his government says, okay, you have a case, I'll do it for you in the WTO. So it's basically a mixture between individuals suing states and states espousing the rights of their citizens to fight it out for them, on behalf of them.
So let me see if I understand. You're saying that these rules that came under the WTO, that were negotiated between countries, have to go to the WTO. But then there are all these bilateral or multilateral agreements, and so they have a different dispute mechanism?
You're right on the dot. We basically now have a constellation of different ways of settling a dispute. And these ways of settling a dispute can be, in the case of investments, either at the World Bank, but it can also be done under arbitration rules agreed upon by the parties. Very often they choose the standard rules designed by the United Nations Center for International Trade Law, UNCITRAL. Sometimes they figure out their own set of laws, and sometimes, let's take on the NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, they have their own dispute settlement rules, their own clauses in the contract, in the trade agreement, where they say, okay, if we have a dispute, this is what we can do, A, B, C. If it were only so easy, because with the whole system of rules, national rules, regional rules, international rules, all the options you have, you can also go like, hey, what's the best forum for my case? Where can I most easily win my case? Because business is very tricky. Business is now internationalized. So companies can have their seats everywhere. They can have their daughters fighting a dispute for the mothers. It's very complicated. So it's not so clean cut. It's multi-layered. It's multifaceted. And you can have parallel litigation fighting your same case at a national, regional, international level, in court, in arbitration, in all sorts of fora. So you're right, very complicated. In principle, we have the big lines that are being mapped out nowadays, but in practice, it is more murky, the situation.
So let's talk about civil society for a moment. Let's suppose that women in the European Union have their own experts who say, yes, the hormone beef is bad, maybe the girls are having puberty sooner, the boys are having not natural puberty, we don't want this. Is there any way that they can enter into these negotiations, or are they simply subject to whatever's worked out between governments and business?
Okay, now in the case of the WTO, the world was not tuned into trade issues as much as we are nowadays. nowadays there is a transatlantic trade pact that's being negotiated, the TPPP, between the US and the EU. And there, the civil society has been very actively engaged. And they are coming up with all sorts of issues, especially what Europeans are very sensitive about, genetically modified organisms, and food standards, but also their own rights in their own countries. Because every treaty, if you make an arrangement with somebody, you give away a bit of your rights. So a treaty will take away a little bit of your rights in return for so-called economic benefits. But a civil society is not as ready to go with the governments as the governments might have wished. So yes, they're actively involved, and yes, there is a role for women.
They're involved in the treaty negotiation part, is that it?
The Trade Commissioner, Karel de Gucht, has made public the negotiating mandate he has from the EU. And it's this is a very nice example, because a trade bloc, a European Union, and a country, the United States, are negotiating. But the Europeans are really trying to be transparent. They're trying to tell their citizens what's going on. And there have been lots of discussions on international blogs about what can be done, what people think should be done, whether the negotiating mandate lies with the European Union or at the level of the national government. Actually, they are figuring this out now, and there will be an advisory opinion from the European Court of Justice. So things are happening, and they are not just accepting that the government negotiates on their behalf, because we all know that with the good things that come with trade deals, there are also some bad things happening, people losing jobs, people being pushed out of the market, enterprises going bust. It's not just win-win-win-win-win, you know, there are winners and losers in the game.
Yes. In Canada, we're concerned about the ability to sustain environmental laws, that we might be sued.
Yes, absolutely. Now, this is a big thing, of course, and I think between the US and the EU, it would not be such a big issue. It might be a more problematic issue when you talk developing countries, developed countries, because sometimes the so-called environmental rules are also used to keep products and goods from developing countries out of the developed countries' markets. So this is then we enter into politics.
And then I guess there was a big issue, and still is a big issue, over unfair subsidies, like the United States subsidizes their agriculture, but yet they're telling less developed countries that they should not subsidize their agriculture.
Right. And the subsidies issue is a big issue. On the one hand, you say we may not subsidize, you distort trade, you know. Let's take in a cotton case. The U.S. subsidizes cotton, the African countries don't. You're competing on the same markets. Not an easy thing, the subsidies issue. On the other hand, if countries were not allowed to subsidize certain areas of activity in agriculture, maybe there would be no farmers, and the food security at the local level might be not guaranteed. And here I must say again, let me say that this I do not say as a UN official. I'm speaking to you in my personal capacity as Chitra Radhakishun, a person who sees things her own way, okay? So in certain things, I would say it depends on the specific situation of the country. If you would talk about my own country, Suriname, which has a population of 400-something thousand, would it be that bad if this tiny drop of subsidies went to help some rice growers to ensure the rice production in Suriname? I don't think so. If it is at a billion-dollar scale, of such a scale that the largest part of your produce goes to export and distorts the market, then I don't know. So the question is not so easy.
No, it's not easy. Now, it's very interesting about the European Union being so open with their citizens about the contents of the trade negotiation as it's going on. In Canada, we have quite the opposite, where we were not officially allowed to see contents of a recent agreement, I believe it was with Europe.
Yes, the CETA.
Until it was actually ratified. There was no opportunity for public input or scrutiny at all. Is there any trend towards preventing this kind of way of springing things on citizens?
For one, I do not wish to comment on the way the Canadian negotiators handle the case, because I'm not well informed about the way they negotiated. On the other hand, I must also say, civil society has not warmed up to trade issues and to trade negotiations issues for a long time. So if you do not go and ask the questions, you will not get the answers. You have to be interested in this area of activity. And it's not an area that has caught the imagination so far in large parts of civil society. Have you heard any of these issues mentioned in this women's Beijing Plus 20 platform? No, very little.
We do hear it mentioned by women and, of course, some men in the North American context. I mean, there are organizations that work on getting leaked copies of things so that they can comment on them in advance. But when you say we haven't warmed up to the issue, do you mean that we just don't know anything about it, or do you mean there's a tendency for civil society to be opposed to the trade negotiations on the whole?
Again, that depends on every country's situation. But if you just look at it historically, most NGOs dealt with human rights issues, with peace issues, with environmental issues, with save the turtles, save the whales, save the sharks, you know. Not so much with what happens in international treaty making. It was really the job of lawyers and professors to look into it and to discuss it, not really civil society. It was not something for which you would jump on a soapbox and make a big speech until things started to have an impact on the population. So only when you say, hey, I don't like this, I don't want to have this product on my plate, I don't want to necessarily conform to this or that or the other standard, that you'll say, gee, is it too late? And I don't think it's ever too late. It's complicated, but never too late. And again, as I said from the beginning, the whole international architecture is in a state of change because the world has become a smaller place. And we have systems that were there for thousands of years. The system of the Americas, the system of the Anglo-Saxons, the systems of the Continentals, the system of the Asians, of the Indians, of the billions of Chinese. So getting common ground is likely to displease everybody.
That's a good line. So you're saying that even if treaties have been negotiated and signed, governments, maybe subsequent governments in those countries, could later change. I mean, I know that Canada, under our current government, decided not to honor its obligations under one of the climate treaties.
Yes. Look, there are rules for states to adhere to under international law. Okay, you can't just sign. It's like a contract. You can't sign a contract and tomorrow you say, well, look, listen, you know, my company signed a contract, but I'm the new manager and basically don't like the contract. You can't say that. So like a state, you can't say that easily either. But as a sovereign state, you have the right to renegotiate. And that's one of the things they are saying now for bilateral investment treaties. You don't like it? You think it's bad for your development? See what you can renegotiate. You can always try to renegotiate. You will have a tougher bargain. It's more difficult to renegotiate than to negotiate.
Right, because each country probably has something that they wanted, and then those are the things they don't want to give up
anymore. It's difficult, it's complex, and societies change very rapidly. There are always new issues that come to the fore. And also, whether it's international trade law, international investment law, international commercial law, in whatever way, it's all connected to a bigger picture. And the bigger picture should remain the well-being of peoples and nations. Now, there are other things that also play a role. You mentioned climate. We mentioned the oceans. We mentioned water. You can also look at war and peace. There are also political issues. We don't like to talk about it, but the political issues sometimes take precedence, and then all of a sudden you hear of a trade embargo or other measures to warn countries that what they are doing is not really correct. So a real, what they call realpolitik, may also influence the way we think about what we want in a treaty, what kind of trade we want to allow, what the level of interdependences we may want to choose.
All right, it's complicated, but we've got to get in there and stand up for what is important to us. Is that more or less the message you have?
And I always say with respect for cross-cultural issues, the way other people do their things, the way other people see the world. And that is something which I am missing in many discussions, where we think that the way it's done at home is the best way to do it. And I can give a very simple example of the what we think is the American way of doing things, that somebody calls me up and says, "Hi, Chitra." And then I say, do I know you, sir? And he says, no. And say, well, why do you call me by my first name? Because that's the way we do it. Well, I say, in my country, we don't. You know, it's a simple issue. People don't even think about it anymore. Because they think that in America, it's all John, Jack, and Frida. And in many parts of the world, would you go to Japan and say to somebody, hi, Ito, you would say Ito-san. You would say in Indonesia, you would say Ibu, which means big sister. I would never call you Frida. I would say Ibu Frida, you know. And in Thailand, I would say Khun. And the Indians have something very nice. They would always say G, means like my respected. So I would say Frida G, you know. So isn't it beautiful to do it that way? Or also the shaking hands and hugging and all that. Now with Ebola, I have seen many people saying, okay, I do it the Thai way. I fold my hands and I say, how are you? Good morning. You know, in some Arab cultures, women and men don't hug publicly. You see, so let's think about that too, because cultural issues can also make a big difference in understanding each other, in understanding the way our systems work, in the way our legal systems work.
So, wait a minute, you're saying that these things have an implication for the legal system?
Absolutely, absolutely. And when I think in culture, I think broader. I think business culture. I think legal culture. If I sign a contract with you, I have a continental law background, which means that my legal system comes from the Romans through Napoleon, through my colonial power, which is Holland in this case. I'm from Suriname, as you know. So I am familiar with the continental way of dealing in the legal system. Now, in the Anglo-Saxon way, it's completely different. You see? So when I sign a contract with you, and let's be honest, it's not government officials who negotiate are not necessarily specialized lawyers who know everything, who know all the differences of the Anglo-Saxon law and the continental law. Let's say that they do. Let's say that you have specialists. But when it comes to implementation, do you think that the average businessman in the different countries that are part of the agreement are aware of the finer differences of their legal systems when they do business? So there may just be a perception issue that you think that what is law and rule in my country would also apply to the other side, because you don't think about it. It's not something that jumps to your mind immediately. So yes, legal culture plays a big role in international treaties.
So a lot of these trade agreements, maybe most of them now, go to special trade courts, or you were saying arbitration. So how is the people who do that arbitration, are they culturally neutral? How does that affect things?
This is one of the issues that is now being discussed in many places. I must say that you have different types of arbitrators. The very skilled arbitrators are aware of the differences and are very sensitive to the differences. And then you have different types of arbitrators for different fields of specialization, and it depends whom you hit upon. So it's like with a doctor, who's the best doctor, like with your hairdresser, who's the best hairdresser, you know, it's a stroke of luck whom you get, or a stroke of being well informed. There are certain types of information that are not readily available, but yes, it would be fine if you could sort of judge your arbitrator by all these criteria. And by the way, if you speak about culture, you know, maybe it's not politically correct to say it, but when in women's associations they describe the modern-day arbitrator, you say the typical arbitrator is white, male, and old. So no women, no room for youngsters, you know, and no room for arbitrators from the South. And it's an exaggeration, of course, because you do have arbitrators from the South. But if you just look at the numbers, you see that this is a little bit skewed.
So how could women get into that field? Last question. Yes.
Frida, I am also a member in my, in one of my capacities, I'm a member of an association called Arbitral Women. And the Arbitral Women have 20 years ago, this year they celebrated their 20th anniversary. They have said, look, listen, this is not working. You know, nobody picks women arbitrators. Nobody picks arbitrators that are from developing countries. We have to do something. Nobody takes young, very skilled, very intelligent, but we are not being chosen. So, of course, I'm not an arbitrator. I am a staff member of the United Nations, and as such, I am following the world of arbitration and international dispute resolution with from a development optique, from a development angle, seeing what are the issues for developing countries and for development. But I'm also a woman in the game. I know what's happening. So, as I said, as a researcher, I became member of Arbitral Women. And Arbitral Women have been fighting for the cause to see, what is it? Is it that we are in the wrong networks? Is it that they don't see us as potentially good arbitrators? What is the issue here? And they have, in a way, also a battlefield of the same things the Beijing platform was talking about, breaking into that segment, breaking in as arbitrators. And I must say, they have built some awareness. You see now that slowly women are being recognized. It starts with a token woman on the arbitration panel. And then it becomes the woman on the arbitration panel and some women on some discussions of arbitration. Yes, but it's one of the battlefields that have not been won yet.
Can you give me the contact information for that organization?
If you go to Google Arbitral Women.
How do you spell it?
Arbitral Women, Women. You will find them on Google, arbitralwomen.org, I think.
Thank you so much, Chitra. This has been fascinating. I learned a vast amount. Yeah.
Chitra Radhakishun is Project Manager on Trade Disputes for the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. She talked with me, Frida Worden, in a UN coffee shop in Geneva, November 4th, 2014. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org and check our daily news feed at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including KCSB-FM in Santa Barbara, California, your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.